The following conversation took place in my apartment in the Old City of Jerusalem with a group of young American Jewish college students who have come to Israel for a two-week vacation. It's in a program called the Birthright Program. These are young people who have almost no background in Judaism whatsoever and basically have come here because they've been subsidized to have a nice vacation. I was asked to speak on spiritual matters, spiritual perspectives, which is one of my favorite subjects. And if you have questions, you may be holding for a little while, but then towards the middle, we'll try to answer them. Everyone is born at a certain spiritual level, with a certain capacity, a certain station. When you're born, say you're right about here, and then throughout life, you go up and down, and hopefully the trend is on a general path going up. Now, how far you will get will be determined by what answers you receive, how much information you receive. The more answers you get, the higher you're going to be able to go. Doesn't mean that everything you hear you have to believe, but you have to listen to it. And then you go away, you go back home, and you try to analyze and see if it was valuable or not, if it works or not. So now I'm going to speak to you about life and death. While a person is alive, the soul is held into the body much like a cork underwater. And throughout the lifetime, the soul is trying to go back up to the spiritual perspective. It remembers instinctively that wonderful light, that wonderful presence that it remembers, but it's being held in the body now as a cork held underwater. What is holding it down are the desires that the body presents to the soul. So it's like a tug of war. The soul is going, oh boy, oh, I remember, I really want a lunch, pizza, basketball, and then the soul follows the body around. And then when the body gets so much basketball it doesn't want anymore, so much pizza it doesn't want anymore, it starts thinking again, maybe there's something more to life than this, and starts thinking spiritually and goes, oh boy, God, I remember now I'm going to go up. And then the next thing pulls it down, it's like a tug of war. This goes on for 120 years. After 120 years, the body lets go, and the soul goes flying up. At this point in time, the soul is confused because it's not used to that perspective of life looking down onto its dead body. Some Hasidim have a custom to go up to a person who just died and to relieve the confusion, say to the dead person, you're dead. And the story goes that the soul looks down from heaven at these two people and says, you don't look so good yourself. What's the point of the story is everybody's on this path. This is not just something that he did. It's something everybody's doing. Okay, everybody goes home from the funeral, and the soul is hanging out over the grave, and nothing to do, very quiet. And then all of a sudden, a huge movie screen comes up, CinemaScope, wraparound movie, Technicolor, great sound, wonderful music, and guess what movie's playing tonight? You know the name of the movie? This Is Your Life, starring who? Guess who? You. And everything you did on your throughout your life comes up on the screen. And now that, your mother and father are sitting next to you, your rabbi is sitting, everybody who ever said anything nice about you is sitting there, the angels are standing watching this movie, and the soul starts getting embarrassed. All those times that person thought they were alone, the cameras were running. All those times they thought they were with only one person and no one would know, cameras were running. A voice comes from heaven and says, you disgusting slob, I sent you into the world to be a holy being, and look what you've done. Well, the soul gets very embarrassed. Your cheeks start burning. That's where the stories of the fires of hell come from, the embarrassment of the soul. Just about when the soul is about to burn away to nothing, a little lady comes running onto the screen with a handkerchief and says, wait a minute, mister, wait a minute. Remember the time that person helped me across the street? Wow, that was a nice thing. The fire's cooled down a little bit. Then all these little coins start rolling onto the screen. Copper coins, silver coins, a couple gold coins. All the charity that that person gave throughout their lifetime comes back to the rescue now and starts elevating the soul. All the good deeds that that soul did come back, and now the soul is flying, going up and up and up, and it really feels like it's going to get out the top. It stops. Oh, you're right in the middle. Yearning to go up more, it can't get up anymore. It looks down below, and there's a guy standing, leaning on the shovel. This was the guy who was throwing the coal on the fire. Now he's just leaning, they're not doing anything. And the soul says, hey, put some more coal on the fire. And the guy said, I can't, you ran out of fuel. What do you mean I ran out of fuel? He says, you used up all your commandments, all your good deeds. He said, you have to do some more good deeds if you want to go up higher. He said, how can I do any more good deeds? I don't even have a body. That's right. So the soul looks over the edge. And this is a nice Jewish man and a Jewish woman come together because it was a Jewish person with a Jewish soul. And it makes a calculation. If I'm born into this situation with that man and woman, I'll go back into the world. I'll do all these wonderful good deeds. And I'll come back really rich and I'll go up even higher. Plop, the soul is in the body. Very crowded in that little tiny place. And not only that, the body's growing. The little baby's body's getting bigger. And not only that, there's an angel in there with the baby. And the angel's job is to teach the baby the entire Torah. It goes over every detail, and the baby says, I got it, I know it this time, don't worry, I won't forget. And the angel says, you're about to be born, don't forget, you're coming into the world to be a spiritual creature, don't be fooled by pizza and basketball. Don't worry, I got it down packed this time. And just then the angel taps the baby under the nose, on the lip, that's where that dent comes from, and the baby forgets almost everything. The baby's born, what's the first thing the baby says? Wah, it's crying, it's born into this world again. What's the second thing the baby says? Give me, I want, me, give me. Some babies say this for 18, 20 years. You laugh at me, but it's true. 30 years, 40 years later, they're still saying, give me, I want. Then somehow a miracle comes, grace comes, and this person, this grown person says, I want a piece of pizza. I'm hungry. But wait a minute. If I'm hungry, maybe he's hungry. Would you like some? And then sharing comes in. Wow, that soul is so relieved. It doesn't have to eat the entire world itself. Somebody else can help eat the world too. According to secular wisdom, success is measured by how much you've gotten. Don't take a pencil and paper and figure out what you're worth. How many businesses, how many houses, how many cars, how many dollars. And so you're measured by how much you've been able to get. Spiritual wisdom teaches you that success is not measured by what you've gotten, but it's measured by what you've given. You're so wealthy, you can give it away. Some people have millions of dollars and they don't know how to give anything away. These are not rich people. Okay, now, what you're doing now, you're in the process of growing spiritually. The fact that you come to Jerusalem at a time like this, the fact that you came here to listen to me speak, you already have some interest in spiritual matters. But the world is not like you think. In fact, it's quite different than you think. But you haven't received this information yet, so you haven't been able to grow from understanding. Let me give you a few examples. Hold your finger in the air. Everybody, hold your finger in the air. Now, when I count to three, quickly point to where you see me. One, two, three, point. Hurry up, come on, point. Don't look at anybody else. You see me over there? Oh, over here, right? The truth of the matter is, you're all wrong. You're totally wrong. The light, moving at 186,000 miles per second, bounces off an object, takes a picture, so to speak, of that object, and then it flies over to your eyes at 186,000 miles per second, touches your eyeballs, turns upside down, goes through the retinas, midbrain, on top of the cortex, it shows you a picture of what you're looking at. Do you understand what I said? So point the way you see me. Totally 180 degrees different. You've never seen anything outside of your head. Can you imagine there's a big dance or a big movie or a big, not a movie, a inauguration ball. And the ones who paid for the biggest tickets get to sit in and watch the real thing. The ones who couldn't afford the biggest tickets sit out in the hall with a big video screen. You've seen those kind of setups, right? Okay, now, is the experience of the people inside watching the live performance exactly the same as the people who are watching the video? No. If you realize that, then you have to stop and think, what have you been seeing your whole life? Because what you've been seeing is more like a video than the real thing, because you cannot see objects. You see pictures of these objects. Do you understand? How's your hearing? Can you hear me over here clearly?
Yes.
No. You hear me over there clearly. To hear me over here clearly, your ears would have to come here. But the sound goes over there. I once told this to somebody, he said he had trouble walking for 3 days because once he realized that he couldn't see objects, then he had trouble walking, maneuvering, because you only see little tiny specks inside your head. Touch is the same thing. Where do you touch something? Well, you'd say on your finger, but it's your brain that tells you. You understand? Okay, now, if you were sent out to kibbutz, you made a wrong turn, and the manager said, okay, I want you to go cut down this tree, and here's a pencil to cut it down with. What would you tell him?
Okay.
Can't cut it down. Why not? What's the problem? What? It's not the right tool. He says, you're right, I made a mistake. I want you to write a book, and here's a chainsaw to write it with. What do you tell him? Pardon me? It's the wrong tool. Okay, from this silly little story, you can tell what job you've been sent to do by looking at the tools you've been given to do it with. Simple?
Right.
Okay, now could you make a good Chinese mother?
Doubtful.
Very doubtful. How about a good coffee table?
No,
not at all. How about a good Jewish man? Huh. All right, so we already identified two of your major tools. You came into the world to be a Jew, and you came into the world to be a man, in your case. Now, what happens if you report back after 120 upstairs and said, I was the best Buddhist girl in the whole class? You blew it, buddy. I sense he's a Jewish man. You're supposed to act like a Jewish man. Just like a chainsaw is good at cutting trees, a Jew is good at cutting at certain things he's got to cut. And we happen to have 4,000 years of books that tell us what a good Jewish person's supposed to do. You all heard about DNA. Well, there's a spiritual DNA also, an overall DNA that we have inherited from our fathers. You realize, of course, you've inherited the physical features of your fathers, of our fathers, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. But you've also inherited the spiritual characteristics of those people. What does that mean? That means when we read the Bible, we're not just reading a history book of what happened a long time ago, but we're reading about the unfoldment of our lives as they unfold each day. Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, our three fathers, have 13 letters in those names. By itself, that wouldn't mean anything. And 13 happens to be the numeral equivalent of the word one. That by itself wouldn't mean anything either. But we look at their wives, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. Four ladies, they have 13 letters also. What this teaches us is that Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are really one person. You. Not to say they were not three gentlemen a long time ago, but today they are one person, you. And you are Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. We have inherited their DNA, both physical and spiritual. Everything that they went through, we go through. Of course, it's on a much watered-down scale because we're so much further away from where they started. Do you understand what I'm saying? So, for instance, in the Bible, King David. King David has to go out and kill Goliath. And King David's a little guy, and Goliath's a big giant. But he has to go out and do it. Who remembers how he did it? Anybody? How?
He took a slingshot.
Took a slingshot and knocked him out, and then took the giant's own sword and cut off his head. This is something you have to do every day of your life. You have to go out and do this. Now, how do you do it? You go home and you get your slingshot early in the morning, and you take out, you don't have a slingshot? You better go to the store and buy a slingshot, buddy, because this is one of the things a Jewish man has to do. And we take it, we keep it in a nice bag, and we go and we take it out. But you know what I'm talking about? Slingshots in those days were not like rubber bands, you know. What did they look like? They had leather straps, and up here they had the pouch that carried, right? You know what we're talking about?
Yeah.
What? Our tefillin, our phylacteries. We get up in the morning, we take our tefillin, we swing it over our head, we hit that evil giant right between the eyes. Between our eyes, on our forehead. The evil giant is the evil inclination. And it's our job to knock out the evil inclination by putting on our tefillin. But to kill him, we have to do it by cutting off his head with his own sword. Now, how do you cut off the evil inclination's head with his own sword? Take some desire that a normal young person your age would have. Don't take it too far. I mean, just we're talking here for a minute. Normally, a young boy has a great desire for for a woman, a girl, I gotta have a girl. Okay, well, that's his evil inclination, his red, hairy beast is trying to take him out there to do this. And you say, okay, fine, you know what? I got a nice Jewish girl here, we'll put up a chuppah, and you'll marry her and go for it. Then it'll become a good deed, what you want to do. We took what would have normally been a deed of the evil inclination, and we elevated it to be a good deed for the good inclination. You understand? All of our desires we can do that way. Don't give into the mere animal aspects of life. Elevate the animal aspects to be the spiritual aspects. For instance, some people have a tough time understanding why we make blessings on everything we do, almost everything, and brachas on food. You got to eat. Everybody has to eat. That's the animal inclination that wants to eat. It's a good thing to eat. But who's going to be in charge, the animal or the spiritual? If you stop and say a blessing before you eat the food, if you make sure the food is kosher, now you're demanding that that animal have certain spiritual guidelines. You've won over your evil inclination in that case. Another guy is just stuffing his face and letting the animal lead him around. Okay, now that takes care of your general DNA, but what about your specific DNA? How do you find out you came into the world to do something? Remember that story about when we're talking about coming back into the world? That's the story of reincarnation. You can find it in the Jewish legal books. There's a story about the Day of Atonement, Yom HaKippur, and everybody's trying to repent. Everybody says, oh, I got to repent. But this one man says, no, I don't want to repent. I've been sinning my whole life, and worst comes to worst, God will come and kill me. And the one commentator there says, no, this man must repent, or he will have to come back to this world again and again until he does repent. So from that we learn that what we do and what we don't do dictates how we're going to come back the next time. So who you are today is a result of who you were yesterday. And who you will be tomorrow is a result of who you are and what you do today. Understanding what I'm saying? So everything that comes for a reason. Nothing just falls out of the sky by accident. So any of your parents, you chose your parents, you chose your face, you chose your lifestyle by either doing very good or neglecting to do good in your last lifetime. Now, how do you find what specific deeds you came to do in this lifetime? You came into the world to be in competition with one person. If you beat this person, you're a winner. And if you don't beat this person, you're a loser. You know who this person is? Who is that person?
Myself.
Yourself yesterday. You just have to be a better person today than you were yesterday and you win. But if you don't, then you're going downhill. You want to be a winner? Do a little bit better than you did yesterday. Okay, now how do you find out the specific things that you came into the world to do? As I said, we're all Jews, so we all have the same DNA as far as our fathers go, but we also have individual DNA that we came into the world with. How do you find out what that is? If you look at your propensities, the things you'd like to do, your gifts, the things you came into the world with, what you do uniquely, these are signs of what you came to do. For instance, if you went to a school with 500 kids in the graduating class, and every Sunday, 499 went to the beach to go swimming, but this one kid went to the hospital to visit the sick. Something unique there. We see that that's something special that that person is doing. That's what that person came to do in the world. Now what you have to do, you have to take your desires that you have, your strongest desires and your talents, and you have to coordinate them with your Jewish overall DNA and elevate that, and then you will receive the reward that you really came into the world to receive. Like for instance, one time I told the story to a young man. He said, but all I like to do is party. I said, you're Jewish? He said, yeah. I said, great. From now on, every Friday night for the rest of your life, you got to have a party. He said, yeah, that's not bad. I said, every Saturday morning a party. Don't forget Saturday night. 7 days of Pesach. If Sukkot is, oh, Purim, you got to get drunk. He said, hey, this is wonderful. Just what I came into the world for. So as I said, we can take our lowest desires and elevate them to be high spiritual desires. Okay, up to here, any questions? You have to speak loudly so everybody can hear you.
You say come to what I can do, good things.
And right.
It's very subjective, like what a good thing is, like it's very individual.
Okay.
So I can say that, hypothetically speaking, killing someone is
what?
A good thing. This is very extreme.
It could be. If there are times killing someone is a good thing.
Or for no reason.
Well, now you're saying that it's not a good thing. Okay, the question was, in case everybody didn't hear it, I said that we're supposed to come into the world to do good, and she said, well, good is subjective. One of the general rules in having a good time is that it feels good when you're doing it, and it also feels good the next day. A lot of things in life feel good when you're doing it, but in the morning you wake up, they don't feel good. But to answer your question more specifically, we have 4,000 years of codes of proper behavior. And we find that those who follow these codes of behavior survive as Jewish people. And those who do not follow these codes of behavior, they may be very nice people, but they do not survive as Jews. Today in America, this is what makes you people so unique, they say that within 25 years there's going to be less than 100,000 Jews. And this 100,000 Jews that will be left will only be ultra-Orthodox people, long black coat kind of people. So from that we see those who guard the commandments and guard the Torah and follow the commandments are the ones who survive. And the Jews, although they may be very nice people who don't follow the commandments and don't protect their families within the laws of Torah, will intermarry. Today, it's a fact that third generation, so-called Reformed Jews, are intermarrying at the rate of 95%. That's what makes you guys so special. When I started out, I told you you're very special people. That's why. Because the future of the Jewish people is in your hands, not mine. You're the ones who can decide whether to make large Jewish families or not. You're the ones who decide whether to marry Jews or not. And that's what you're here for. That's the whole idea of the program that brought you to Israel, to let you learn it's a good thing to be a Jew and meet other Jewish people to prevent intermarriage. And that's why I'm happy that I got getting the opportunity to speak to you today. Now, I have another entire subject I'd like to talk to you about, but first I'd like to hear your questions. Nice and loud, please.
Why do you have to fill in the different traditions, Jewish traditions? Why is that better than holding a Jewish belief of tradition, kind of community and morality and all these things like intermarrying, why is that so important?
Why is intermarrying important? Is that what you just said?
Why is all of these sort of...
Okay, well, I hope I can answer all your questions. First off...
Or having sex after marriage and...
Well, let me forget the first one first. Personally, I get up at, don't tell anybody, at 2:20 every morning, and I run to the mikveh, and I run to the kotel to be there 3 hours before sunrise to get to put on my tefillin. I love it. When I lived in India, I used to stand without clothes on inside a briar bush on one leg. And if I'd move 2 inches, a quarter of an inch in any direction, I'd bleed most directions. When I came here to do tshuva, to return to Judaism, I asked, what do you have to do to get it? Stand on your head for 2 weeks? He said, no, eat a matzah. Eat a matzah, that's fun, that's right. These are our spiritual exercises that bring us to the revelation. They're spiritual tools. I'll give it to you in a different way. Let's try to hear it this way. One time a guy was praying at the wall, and he said, God, I need $400. And a voice came from heaven and said, I gave it to you. He said, where? He said, I gave it to you in your heart. My heart, what good is that? I got to pay the bills. So the same thing with us. It's not good enough only to have good intentions. We have to have good deeds also. And we're not saying that those good deeds in your case, that person had, he was a nice person, had community interest in those are very good deeds, and they are constructive things. In fact, if you look in the Torah, you'll find out they're even called mitzvahs, commandments. But if a person will follow only the logical good deeds, like it's very logical to help your community, but not the spiritual good deeds that don't seem so logical, such as putting on tefillin, then there's no reason they won't marry the non-Jewish girl next door.
Why is that?
Why is putting on tefillin spiritual? I'm using that as opposed to something logical. A logical good deed is like not to steal from someone.
Right, I know. But why is tefillin spiritual?
Well, if you come tomorrow morning at 4:30 to the kotel, or even today after we're done, we'll go there and I'll show you more about it. But if you put it on with a good heart, It says in the Torah, you should take these words of mine and bind them for a sign upon your arm. So the scribe took a feather for a pen and a long thin piece of parchment and wrote these commandments out very carefully in ancient Hebrew and wrapped them up and put them in the leather box we put on our arm. We put it on our arm, which signifies we'll do them, and on our head we'll think about them. What are these commandments that God has commanded us to do? Now, every religion in the world prays. Every religion bows. There's certain things all religions have in common. But tefillin is a Jewish thing. Only Jews do that. No religion in the world will ever see it. If you see anybody putting on tefillin, you've got to say, that's a Jew. And it's called a sign between God and the Jewish people that you are my people. Did you ever hear of the Dead Sea Scrolls? Okay, they found in the cave back in the 40s these scrolls that are 2,000 years old. And they're written just like our scrolls today. Also in the cave, they found hundreds of pairs of tefillin. This is not something that we just made up. When they found the helmets in Masada, they had square holes here for the tefillin. Whenever the non-Jew tries to conquer the Jewish nation with the Romans or the Greeks, whoever they were, they want to outlaw tefillin and circumcision. They want to make us just like them, doing good deeds like they do, like don't steal, don't murder, help the community, the logical good deeds. But it's the spiritual good deeds that we do that help us to survive as Jewish people, not just as good people. Now, Judaism is not a religion. I don't know if you learned that or not, and I hope I don't step on anybody's teaching here, but I don't think I will. Every religion in the world is based on one thing only, belief. If somebody believes in the Christian Bible, they are a Christian. And if the next day they stop believing in the Christian Bible and believe in the sutras from Buddhism, they are no longer Christian, they're Buddhist. And if the next day they don't believe in that, but they believe in the Quran, now they are a Muslim. A Jew is not like that. A Jew is a Jew no matter what he or she believes. So if a Jew believes he's a Buddhist, he calls himself a Jewish Buddhist, or a Jewish Muslim, or a Jewish whatever, because we're a people. What makes a Jew is not their head, but their mother. It's passed down from the mother to the child. And this goes all the way back to the history of the first Jews in the world. It was always passed down by the mother. Not something the rabbis made up. Questions on any of this so far? We got a lot more to talk about. What? Please speak up, though.
Someone who's not born Jewish.
Right.
Who doesn't steal and doesn't kill people and is, good in the community. Is that, good enough?
The non-Jew has been commanded seven basic commandments. And if the non-Jew will keep his seven basic commandments, he's called a righteous person, a tzaddik. You'll have a wonderful share in this world and a share in the world to come. We are to honor these people, to love them, and to respect them. And if they come to the land here, we're even to support them if they need support. If somebody can read that for me, and we'll find out what that question is.
Where do women fit in? I wonder what's wrong.
That's a very good question. A secular marriage, in order to be successful, they tell you it has to be 50-50 partners. 50-50, equal partners, man and woman. I did the dishes yesterday, you do them today. A Jewish marriage, a Torah marriage, is not like that at all. In fact, a Torah marriage would say that's a recipe for disaster. In a Jewish marriage, the two people come together and make one body. We have four hands, four legs, 12 kids, what do? So the Jewish woman, Makabels, receives the mitzvah, the commandment of tefillin, through her husband. And the husband gets the mitzvah, if you will, of Shabbos candles because the wife lights the Shabbos candles. It's one, the family unit is one, not two halves. That's a very good question. I'm glad you asked that. While we're speaking about women's issues, it's a very interesting concept that right now, because the Messiah is coming soon, all the souls that are still up in heaven want to reincarnate and come back into this world. There are many, many more souls that want to come into the world than there are available women to birth them. So over each Jewish woman are many, many, maybe as many 50 Jewish souls that want to be born. Now, which of these souls will have the opportunity to come through you as a particular person will depend upon how you live your life today. For instance, if you're the type of woman who goes to the beach and goes to the bars drinking, kind of a like, not so fussy type person with a person's morality, then any of these souls could come into that body. But if you are a lady who guards her modesty and you're very particular about the way you conduct yourself, then only those souls that merit that type of woman will be able to come into your body. Speaking of living a holy life, everyone knows when you give charity, it brings light into the world. But when does that light come into the world? When you put the coin in the person's hand? Or when you let go of the coin? Well, if you say when it gets to the hand, you have to let go of the coin before it's going to get to the hand. But then if it's when you let go of the coin, the light comes into the world, then you have to say when you reach in your pocket to get the coin. And if you say when you reach in your pocket, then you have to say when you go to work to earn the coin. And that's the secret to a holy life. If your intention when you go to work is to make money in order to do good deeds, in order to give charity, to educate your children, to keep the family healthy and happy, then your work is holy work. But if you're going to work only to succeed, to make more money, to be a better, more famous person, then you're going to work as a slave, and your work controls you. When you go to do a good deed, all the steps on the way are also a part of that good deed. And this is how you can live a holy life all the days of your life. Question?
Why is the Jewishness passed down to the mother?
Okay.
Why marry a non-Jewish woman and have a child? Why can't
they? God forbid. God forbid. I'll tell you why. Did you read a little bit of the Bible ever?
Sure, yes.
Okay, who's the father of the Jewish people?
Abraham.
Abraham. And he had a wife named?
Rachel.
Sarah.
Sarah.
Right. Now, they had a problem. They couldn't have a child. So what did they do? Sarah dreamed up a scheme to give her slave to Abraham and to be a surrogate mother, and then it would be like Sarah's baby too, kind of. Anybody remember the name of that slave? What?
Hagar.
Hagar, right, very good. Now, Abraham agreed to that and had a baby with Hagar. And what was that baby's name?
Ishmael.
Ishmael, right? Okay, name later, a miracle came and Sarah had a baby. What was that baby's name?
Isaac.
Yitzchak, Isaac, okay? Now, if Judaism went by the father, which of these two kids would be Jews?
Both
of them. Are both those kids Jews?
No.
Yeah.
Ishmael says he's not a Jew, he's an Arab. Yeah, but what?
Based on what?
Based on how he, look at Ishmael, ask him. He doesn't, if an Arab comes to the Kotel, he won't even put on a yarmulke. He doesn't want to be associated with the Jewish people. He wants to associate with Ishmael, that's his tribes. We associate with Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov because of Sarah. Without Sarah as the mother, those fathers wouldn't have helped. Yes, please speak up.
I'm going to contradict you, but with that argument, then
Esau,
who had a Jewish mother, should also...
Esau is. He's called the puzzle Jew. The question has to do with Esau, which is the twin brother of Yaakov. And Yaakov is the good inclination. Esau is the evil inclination. But he's a Jew. But he's a puzzle Jew, a non-kosher Jew. And he went off the path and he married in a non-Jewish way. And his children are all non-Jewish today. Just because a person's non-Jewish doesn't mean they're a bad person. Don't get that. I'm not implying that whatsoever. But for the Jewish people to survive, there must be a Jewish woman. That's why it's essential that you marry a girl whose mother's Jewish, or a boy even whose mother's Jewish, to keep the Jewish people alive. The panda bears, everybody's going nuts over the panda bears in America now because they're endangered species. How about the elephants? You think the elephants should survive? Should we do something to help them survive?
Okay.
What? Okay?
Okay.
How much more so your own people? And nobody says 95% of the elephants are disappearing, but they're saying that about our people. That's why you're so precious. That's the future. The future of the Jewish people is not in my hands, it's in your hands. That's why you must marry a Jewish person. And by the way, it's better that way for everybody. Question out loud, please.
Well, what if you, like, Okay, in Hinduism, the most important thing with marriage is to preserve Judaism, and that's the most main concern. It's what about the love that you have with the other person? Once you are truly in love with the person, want to spend the rest of your life with.
Okay, answer your question. Who knows the center of Judaism? What the center of Judaism is? Is it the Torah? Is it the temple? The synagogue?
I thought it was the values and
the community. The teachings? Is that the center? Who knows? What's the center of Judaism? The home. Now, what's the home? Who knows what the home is? The woman. The Jewish woman, bayit is a house, bat, the same word, is daughter. The Jewish woman is the center of Torah, because the vouchsafing and survival of the Jewish people is depending upon her. Now, as far as love goes, to answer that question, I don't know about you, but most people have fallen in love with many things that they weren't in love with the next day. Your heart can lead you astray. In your mezuzah, the scroll on your door, and in the scrolls on the tefillin, we're warned, do not follow your heart. It will lead you astray. And I'm a very good example of that. I strayed all over the world for 40 years before I found Torah. You can't trust your heart. You have to have your head come in there too. That doesn't mean to marry someone you don't love. Nobody's saying that. But it's easy to love Jews. Nice people. Did that answer your question? I hope. Loving somebody is not enough reason. There must be more than love. Because people have loved things today, and the next day they're not in love with those things. That's an emotion.
Okay, let's say you have this connection with this person, that you could, with any Jewish person, that this person happens not to be Jewish, and you have all the qualifications that would make.
That's not true, because you see, that's all an emotional thing. You being a Jewish person with your your DNA and this other person, you're sharing the same heritage, even if you don't follow the Torah, the same ancestors, the same deep down values. I'm not talking about your intellectual values that you learn from the country and the people you're living with. We share the same history, so we're more compatible with each other to begin with. Of course, you have to find someone that you love and someone you respect. It's essential. You don't marry somebody just because they're a Jew. I'm not suggesting that. But I'm saying you must marry a Jewish person if you want our tribes of people to survive. What question? No more questions?
You know that 12 minutes left is up. Could you maybe a hands-on meditation for 2 or 3 minutes?
Okay, we're going to do a meditation, okay, because we only have about 12 minutes left. And let's try to make this, we'll do it in different stages. When everyone's ready, because it should be quiet when you do this. We're going to do the easy one first, and perhaps it's better to sit with your feet flat on the floor, but sit however you're comfortable. Close your eyes. If your hands are together, don't interlock the fingers. It's better to have the right hand, if you want them together, the right hand would be over the left. And let's do this meditation first. I want you to sit, and I want you to picture everyone in your family one at a time. Try to see them with light on their face and smiling. And pray for their well-being. They should be healthy. You're sending them good wishes from the holiest place in the world. Picture one at a time. Just see them for a brief second. You can't hold their face in front of your mind. Mom and dad, your family, friends. Now picture yourself succeeding the thing that you want to have happen. Let's do this and pray for our soldiers, that God should guard them. And all of you will be safe in your journey. That's one good exercise. Here's another one. There's a prayer we say, Baruch Chei HaOlamim, blessed be the life in all the worlds. This tells us that there are many worlds, but only one life. For a moment, try to understand and conceive how it is that one life is sitting in this room, although there are many people. all these times you thought your life was a separate life. It's not. It's one life that's filling everyone. Okay, now this meditation we're going to do now is a little more difficult. Imagine the place in front of you. And this place continues and goes on behind you, around you, through you, above you, and below you. And conceive of the place, not the things that are in it, but the place itself. It goes in every direction and fills the universe. Place is one of God's names. These are some typical exercises that you can use to come to a peaceful state and some clarity in your life. Okay, I want to talk to you interested in spiritual matters. I'd like to give you one more little exercise, not necessarily meditation, but something you should understand. When you look at people in the room, you see people. But if you put a big microscope in between you and the people, you don't see people. You see molecules, zillions of molecules. So what is that? Is that a person or is that molecules you're seeing? Now scientists tell us that molecule, that empty space in the body is 99.9% of the body. And the rest of the molecules. Are those molecules solid? Blow them up real, real big. We'll see that they're 99% empty space and zillion of atoms. Are the atoms solid? Blow them up real, real big. You come to zillion of quarks. Blow those up, you come to gluons, keep going and going and going. And whatever you come to, blow it up larger and larger and larger. What do you finally come to? Anybody know? Whatever you tell me, I'm going to tell you to magnify it bigger. Anyone have an idea? What do you think you come to?
Energy.
Blow that up real big.
Empty space.
Empty space. Because the world is made out of nothing. And although we're experiencing it as something, which is a valid perspective, underlying it is nothing. Any of you kids study science or physics? No, not one of the hot studies today? What would happen if gravity would cease? All gravity. Any idea? What? You fly off? Okay, but that's just if the Earth's gravity left, and then the bodies would fly off. But if all gravity left, then the whole body would come apart. Yes or no? You understand what happened?
Yeah.
What would be left?
Nothing.
Nothing. So that all that's really here is a power holding it all together.
Oh, it's spirit.
Okay, the physical universe we're talking about there. And next time you come, we'll talk about the spiritual universe too, if you like, but there's much to be taught about that. Any other questions now? Because we're running out of the allotted time. The other kids will be waiting at the bus. Maybe we'll go take a look, stand on the roof for a moment before you leave. You can warm up, you poor kids that have colds, and coughing, sniffling. And if you're around Friday night, want to come for dinner, let me know, all right? Avi has my phone number. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.